12 people lived under the Misbegot Bridge, and in a life of luxury, although luxury is not hard to achieve when you define it as something to eat at least once a day, and especially when you have such a broad definition of something to eat. Technically, they were beggars, although they seldom had to beg. Possibly they were thieves, although they only took what had been thrown away, usually by people hurrying to be out of their presence. Outsiders considered that the leader of the group was Coffin Henry, who would have been the city's champion expectorator if anyone else had wanted the title. But the group had the true democracy of the voteless. There was Arnold Sideways, whose lack of legs only served to give him an extra advantage in any pub fight, where a man with good teeth at groin height had it all his own way. And if it wasn't for the duck whose presence on his head he consistently denied, the duck man would have been viewed as well-spoken and educated, and as sane as the next man. Unfortunately, the next man was foul old Ron. The other 8 people were altogether Andrews. Altogether Andrews was one man with considerably more than one mind. In a rest state, when he had no particular problem to confront, there was no sign of this except a sort of background twitch and flicker as his features passed randomly under the control of variously Jossie, Lady Hermione, Little Sydney, Mr. Viddle, Curly, the Judge, and Tinker. There was also Burke, but the crew had only ever seen Burke once and never wanted to again, so the other 7 personalities kept him buried. Nobody in the body answered to the name of Andrews. In the opinion of the Duckman, who was probably the best in the crew at thinking in a straight line, Andrews had probably been some innocent and hospitable person of a psychic disposition who had simply been overwhelmed by the colonising souls. Only among the gentle crew under the bridge could a consensus person like Andrews find an accommodating niche. They'd welcomed him, or them, to the fraternity around the smoky fire. Someone who wasn't the same person for more than 5 minutes at a time could fit right in. One other thing that united the crew, although probably nothing could unite altogether Andrews, was a readiness to believe that a dog could talk. The group around the smouldering fire believed they had heard a lot of things talk, such as walls. A dog was easy by comparison. Besides, they respected the fact that Gaspode had the sharpest mind of the lot and never drank anything that corroded the container. "Let's try this again, shall we?" he said. "If you sell 30 of the things, you'll get a dollar. A whole dollar. Got that?"
"Bugger it. Quack."
"How much is that in old boots?" Gaspode sighed. "No, Arnold, you can use the money to buy as many old..." There was a rumble from Altogether Andrews, and the rest of the crew went very still. When Altogether Andrews was quiet for a while, you never knew who he was going to be. There was always the possibility that it would be Burke.
"Can I ask a question?" said Altogether Andrews in a rather hoarse treble.
The crew relaxed. That sounded like Lady Hermione. She wasn't a problem.
"Yes, your ladyship?"
"This wouldn't be work, would it?"
The mention of the word sent the rest of the crew into a fugue of stress and bewildered panic.
"Bagger it, quack."
"No, no, no," said Gaspode hurriedly. "It's hardly work, is it? Just handing out stuff and taking money. Doesn't sound like work to me."
"I ain't working," shouted Coffin Henry. "I am socially inadequate in the whole area of doing anything."
"We do not work," said Arnold Sideways. "We is gentlemen of leisure."
"Ahem," said Lady Hermione.
"Gentlemen and ladies of leisure," said Arnold gallantly.
"This is a very nasty winter. Extra money would certainly come in handy," said the Duckman.
"What for?" said Arnold.
"We could live like kings on a dollar a day, Arnold."
"What, you mean someone would chop our heads off?"
"No, I..."
"Someone would climb up inside a privy with a red-hot poker and..."
"No, I meant someone would drown us in a butt of wine."
"No, that's dying like kings, Arnold."
"I shouldn't reckon there's a butt of wine big enough that you couldn't drink your way out of," muttered Gaspode.
"So what about it, masters? Oh, and mistress, of course. Shall Ron tell the lad that we're up for it?"
"Indeed."
"Okay." "Bagger it."
They looked at Altogether Andrews. His lips moved, his face flickered. Then he held up 5 democratic fingers.
"The ayes have it," said Gaspode.
Mr. Pin lit a cigar. Smoking was his one vice. At least, it was his only vice that he thought of as a vice. All the others were just job skills. Mr. Tulip's vices were also limitless, but he owned up to cheap aftershave because a man has to drink something. The drugs didn't count, if only because the only time he'd ever got real ones was when they'd robbed a horse doctor and he'd taken a couple of big pills that had made every vein in his body stand out like a purple hosepipe. The pair were not thugs. At least, they did not see themselves as thugs, nor were they thieves. At least they never thought of themselves as thieves. They did not think of themselves as assassins. Assassins were posh and had rules. Pin and Tulip, the new firm, as Mr. Pin liked to refer to themselves, did not have rules. They thought of themselves as facilitators. They were men who made things happen, men who were going places. It has to be added that when one says they thought, it means Mr. Pin thought. Mr. Tulip used his head all the time, from a distance of about 8 inches, but he was not, except in one or two unexpected areas, a man given much to using his brain. On the whole, he left Mr. Pin to do the polysyllabic cogitation. Mr. Pin, on the other hand, was not very good at sustained mindless violence, and admired the fact that Mr. Tulip had an apparently bottomless supply. When they had first met, and had recognised in each other the qualities that would make their partnership greater than the sum of its parts, he'd seen that Mr. Tulip was not, as he appeared to the rest of the world, just another nut job. Some negative qualities can reach a pitch of perfection that changes their very nature, and Mr. Tulip had turned anger into an art. It was not anger at anything. It was just pure, platonic anger from somewhere in the reptilian depths of the soul, a fountain of never-ending red-hot grudge. Mr. Tulip lived his life on that thin line most people occupy just before they haul off and hit someone repeatedly with a spanner. For Mr. Tulip, anger was the ground state of being. Pin had occasionally wondered what had happened to the man to make him as angry as that. But to Tulip, the past was another country, with very, very well-guarded borders. Sometimes Mr. Pin heard him screaming at night. It was quite hard to hire Mr. Tulip and Mr. Pin. You had to know the right people. To be more accurate, you had to know the wrong people. And you got to know them by hanging around a certain kind of bar and surviving, which was kind of a first test. The wrong people, of course, would not know Mr. Tulip and Mr. Pin, but they would know a man, and that man would, in a general sense, express the guarded opinion that he might know how to get in touch with men of a pin-like or tulipolitic disposition. He could not exactly recall much more than that at the moment, due to memory loss brought on by lack of money. Once cured, he might indicate in a general kind of way another address where you would meet in a dark corner a man who would tell you emphatically that he had never heard of anyone called Tulip or Pin. He would also ask you where you would be at, say, 9 o'clock tonight. And then you would meet Mr. Tulip and Mr. Pin. They would know you had money, they would know you had something on your mind, and, if you had been really stupid, they now knew your address. It had therefore come as a surprise to the new firm that their latest client had come straight to them. This was worrying. It was also worrying that he was dead. Generally, the new firm had no problem with corpses, but they didn't like them to speak. Mr. Slant coughed. Mr. Pin noticed that this created a small cloud of dust, for Mr. Slant was a zombie.
"I must reiterate," said Mr. Slant, "that I am a mere facilitator in this matter."
"Just like us," said Mr. Tulip.
Mr. Slant indicated with a look that he would never in 1,000 years be just like Mr. Tulip, but he said,
"Quite so. My clients wished me to find some experts. I found you. I gave you some sealed instructions. You have accepted the contract. And I understand that as a result of this, you have made certain arrangements. I do not know what those arrangements are. I will continue not to know what those arrangements are. My relationship with you is, as they say, on the long finger. Do you understand me?
What ing finger is that? Said Mr. Tulip. He was getting jittery in the presence of the dead lawyer.
We see each other only when necessary. We say as little as possible.
I hate ing zombies, said Mr. Tulip. That morning he tried something he'd found in a box under the sink. If it cleaned drains, he'd reasoned, that meant it was chemical. Now he was getting strange messages from his large intestine.
I am sure the feeling is mutual, said Mr. Slant.
I understand what you're saying, said Mr. Pin. You're saying that if this goes bad, you've never seen us in your life.
Mr. Slant coughed. Your after life, Mr. Pin corrected himself.
Okay, what about the money?
As requested, $30,000 for special expenses will be included in a sum already agreed.
In gems, not cash.
Of course. And my clients would hardly write you a check. It will be delivered tonight. And perhaps I should mention one other matter.
His dry fingers shuffled through the dry papers in his dry briefcase, and he handed Mr. Pin a folder. Mr. Pin read it. He turned a few pages quickly.
You may show it to your monkey, said Mr. Slant.
Mr. Pin managed to grab Mr. Tulip's arm before it reached the zombie's head. Mr. Slant did not even flinch.
He's got the story of our lives, Mr. Tulip.
So I can still rip his ing-stitched-on head right off.
No, you cannot, said Mr. Slant. Your colleague will tell you why.
Because our legal friend here will have made a lot of copies, won't you, Mr. Slant? And probably lodged them in all kinds of places in case he...
Of accidents, said Mr. Slant smoothly. Well done. You have had an interesting career so far, gentlemen. You are quite young. Your talents have taken you a long way in a short time and given you quite a reputation in your chosen profession. While, of course, I have no idea about the task you are undertaking, no idea whatsoever, I must stress, I have no doubt that you will impress us all.
"Does he know about the contract in Quirm?" said Mr. Tulip.
"Yes," said Mr. Pin.
"That stuff with the wine netting and the crabs and that ing banker?"
"Yes."
"And the thing with the puppies and that kid?"
"He does now," said Mr. Pin. "He knows nearly everything. Very clever. You believe you know where the bodies are buried, Mr. Slant?"
"I've talked to one or two of them," said Mr. Slant. "But it would appear that you have never committed a crime within Ankh-Morpork. Otherwise, of course, I could not talk to you."
"Who says we've never committed a ing crime in Ankh-Morpork?" Mr. Tulip demanded in an offended tone.
"As I understand it, you have never been to this city before."
"Well, we've had all ing day."
"Have you been caught?" said Mr. Slant.
"No."
"Then you have committed no crime. May I express the hope that your business here does not involve any kind of criminal activity?"
"Perish the thought," said Mr. Pin.
"The city watch here are quite dogged in some respects, and the various guilds jealously guard their professional territories."
"We hold the police in high regard," said Mr. Pin. "We have a great respect for the work they do."
"We ing love policemen," said Mr. Tulip.
"If there was a policeman's ball, we would be among the first to buy a ticket," said Mr. Pin.
"Specially if it was mounted on a plinth or a little display stand of some sort,"
said Mr. Tulip, "'cause we like beautiful things.'
"'I just wanted to be sure that we understood one another,' said Mr. Slant, snapping his case closed.
He stood up, nodding to them, and walked stiffly out of the room.
"'What up?'
Mr. Tulip began, but Mr. Pin raised a finger to his lips. He crossed silently to the door and opened it. The lawyer had gone.
"'He knows what we're in here for,' Mr. Tulip whispered hotly. "'What's he in pretending for?'
"'Because he's a lawyer,' said Mr. Pin. "'Nice place, this,' he added in a slightly overloud voice. Mr. Tulip looked around.
"'Nah,' he said dismissively. "'I thought that at the start, but it's just a late 18th century copy of the Ing Baroque style. They got the dimensions all wrong. Did you see them pillars in the hall, did you? Ing 6th century Ephebian with Second Empire Jellybabian Ing finials. It was all I could do not to laugh.'
"'Yes,' said Mr. Pin. "'As I have remarked before, Mr. Tulip, in many ways you are a very unexpected man.'
Mr. Tulip walked over to a shrouded picture and tweaked the cloth aside. "'Well, me, it's a Ing de Quirm,' he said. "'Us in a print of it. Woman holding ferret. He did it just after he moved from Genoa and was influenced by Ing Caravatti. Look at that Ing brushwork, will you? See the way the line of the hand draws the Ing eye into the picture? Look at the quality of the light on the landscape you can see through the Ing window there. See the way the ferret's nose follows you around the room? That's ingenious, that is. I don't mind telling you that if I was here by myself, I'd be in Ing tears.
It's very pretty.
Pretty? Said Mr. Tulip, despairing of his colleague's taste.
He walked over to a statue by the door and stared hard at it, then ran his fingers lightly across the marble.
I thought so. This is a Ing Scolpini, I bet anything. But I've never seen it in a catalogue, and it's been left in an empty house where anyone could just Ing walk in and nick it.
This place is under powerful protection. You saw the seals on the door?
Guilds. Bunch of Ing amateurs. We could go through this place like a hot knife through Ing thin ice, and you know it. Amateurs and rocks and lawn ornaments and dead men walking about. We could knock this Ing city over.
Mr. Pin said nothing. A similar idea had occurred to him, but unlike with his colleague, deed did not automatically follow upon what passed for thought. The firm had indeed not operated in Ankh-Morpork before. Mr. Pin had kept away because, well, there were plenty of other cities, and an instinct for survival had told him that the big wahoonie, the world's rarest and most evil-smelling vegetable, and consequently much prized by connoisseurs, who seldom prize anything cheap and common, also a slang name for Ankh-Morpork, although it does not smell as bad as that. An instinct for survival had told him that the big wahoonie should wait a while. He'd had a plan, ever since he'd met Mr. Tulip and found that his own inventiveness, combined with Tulip's incessant anger, promised a successful career. He'd developed their business in Genoa, Pseudopolis, Quirm, cities smaller and easier to navigate than Ankh-Morpork, although these days it seemed they increasingly resembled it. The reason that they had done well, he'd realised, was that sooner or later people went soft. Take the trollish Breccia, for instance. Once the honk and slab route had been established all the way to Überwald, and the rival clans had been eliminated, the trolls had got soft. The tons acted like society lords. It was the same everywhere. The big old gangs and families reached some kind of equilibrium with society and settled down to be a specialist kind of businessman. They cut down on henchmen and employed butlers instead. And then, when there was a bit of difficulty, they needed muscle that could think. And there was the new firm, ready and willing. And waiting. One day there'd be time for a new generation, Mr. Pin thought. One with a new way of doing things. One without the shackles of tradition holding them back. Happening people. Mr. Tulip, for example, happened all the time.
"Hey, will you, Ing, look at this?" said the happening Tulip, who had uncovered another painting. "Signed by Gogli, but it's a Ing fake. Look at the way the light falls here, will you? And the leaves on this tree. If
Ingogley painted that. It was with his ing foot. Probably some ing pupil.
While they had been marking time in the city, Mr. Pin had followed Mr. Tulip, trailing scouring powder and canine worming tablets through one after another of the city's art galleries. The man had insisted. It had been an education, mostly for the curators. Mr. Tulip had the instinct for art, which he did not have for chemistry. Sneezing icing sugar and dribbling foot powder, he was ushered into private galleries where he ran his bloodshot eye over nervously proffered trays of ivory miniatures. Mr. Pin had watched in silent admiration while his colleague spoke colourfully and at length on the differences between ivory faked the old way with bones and the ing new way the ing dwarfs had come up with using ing refined oil, chalk and ing spirits of knackle. He'd lurched over to the tapestries, declaimed at length about high and low weaving, burst into tears in front of a verdant scene, and then demonstrated that the gallery's prized 13th-century Stolat tapestry couldn't be more than 100 years old because, see that ing bit of purple there? No way was that ing dye around then. And what's this? An Agatean embalming pot from the Pegisu dynasty? Someone took you to the ing cleaners, mister. The glaze is rubbish. It was astounding, and Mr. Pin had been so enthralled that he'd all but forgotten to slip a few small valuable items into his pocket. But in truth, he was familiar with Tulip on art. When they had occasionally to torture premises, Mr. Tulip always made sure that any truly irreplaceable pieces were removed first, even though that meant taking extra time to tie the inhabitants to their beds. Somewhere under that self-inflicted scar tissue, and at the heart of that shuddering anger, was the soul of a true connoisseur with an unerring instinct for beauty. It was a strange thing to find in the body of a man who would mainline bath salts. The big doors at the other end of the room swung open, revealing the dark space beyond. "Mr. Tulip?" said Mr. Pin. Mr. Tulip drew himself away from a painstaking examination of a possible Tapasi table, with its magnificent inlay work involving dozens of ing rare veneers.
"Huh?"
"Time to meet the bosses again," said Mr. Pin. William was just getting ready to leave his office for good when someone knocked at the door. He opened it cautiously, but it was pushed the rest of the way.
"You utterly, utterly ungrateful person!"
It wasn't a nice thing to be called, especially by a young lady. She used a simple word like ungrateful in a way that would require a dash and an ing in the mouth of Mr. Tulip. William had seen Saccharissa Cripslock before, generally helping her grandfather in his tiny workshop. He'd never paid her much attention. She wasn't particularly attractive, but she wasn't particularly bad-looking either. She was just a girl in an apron, doing slightly dainty things in the background, such as light dusting and arranging flowers. Insofar as he'd formed any opinion of her, it was that she suffered from misplaced gentility and the mistaken belief that etiquette meant good breeding. She mistook mannerisms for manners. Now he could see her a lot plainer, mostly because she was advancing towards him across the room, and in the light-headed way of people who think they're just about to die, he realised that she was quite good-looking, if considered over several centuries. Concept of beauty change over the years, and 200 years ago, Saccharissa's eyes would have made the great painter Caravaggio bite his brush in half. 300 years ago, the sculptor Mauvais would have taken one look at her chin and dropped his chisel on his foot. 1,000 years ago, the Ephesian poets would have agreed that her nose alone was capable of launching at least 40 ships, and she had good medieval ears. Her hand was quite modern, though, and it caught William a stinging blow on the cheek.
"That $20 a month was nearly all we had."
"Sorry, what?"
"All right, he isn't very fast, but in his day he was one of the best engravers in the business."
"Oh, yes, William had a sudden flash of guilt about Mr. Cripslock.
"And you took it away just like that."
"I didn't mean to. The dwarfs just... things just happened."
"You're working for them?"
"Sort of with them," said William.
"While we starve, I suppose."
Saccharissa stood there panting. She had a well-crafted supply of other features that never go out of fashion at all and are perfectly at home in any century. She clearly believed that severe old-fashioned dresses toned these down. They did not.
"Look, I'm stuck with them," said William, trying not to stare. "I mean, stuck with the dwarfs. Lord Vetinari was very definite about it, and it's suddenly all become very complicated. "'The Guild of Engravers is going to be livid about this. "'You do know that?' she demanded.
"'Yes.' "'A desperate idea struck William rather harder than her hand.
"'That's a point. "'You wouldn't like to, be official about that, would you? "'You know, we are livid,' says spokeswoman for the Guild of Engravers.
"'Why?' she said suspiciously.
"'I'm desperate for things to put in my next edition,' said William desperately. "'Look, can you help me? "'I can give you, 20 pence an item, and I could use at least 5 a day.'
"'She opened her mouth to snap a reply, but calculation cut in.
"'A dollar a day?' she said. "'More if they're nice and long,' said William wildly. "'For that letter thing you do?'
"'Yes.
"'A dollar?'
"'Yes.
"'She eyed him with mistrust. "'You can't afford that, can you? "'I thought you only got $30 yourself, you told Grandfather.
"'Things have moved on a bit. "'I haven't caught up with it myself, to tell you the truth.' "'She was still looking at him doubtfully, "'but natural Ankh-Morpork interest in the distant prospect of a dollar "'was gaining the upper hand.
"'Well, I hear things,' she began, "'and, well, writing things down, I suppose that's a suitable job for a lady, isn't it? It's practically cultural.
Close, I suppose.
I wouldn't like to do anything that wasn't proper.
Oh, I'm sure it's proper.
And the Guild can't object to that, can they? You've been doing it for years, after all.
Look, I'm just me, said William. If the Guild object, they'll have to sort it out with the patrician.
Well, all right. "'If you're sure it's an acceptable job for a young lady.'
"'Come down to the printing works tomorrow, then,' said William. "'I think we ought to be able to produce another paper of news in a few days.' This was a ballroom, still plush in red and gold, but musty in the semi-darkness and ghostly with its shrouded chandeliers. The candlelight in the centre was dimly reflected from the mirrors around the walls. They had probably once brightened the place up considerably, but over the years some sort of curious tarnish had blotched its way across them, so that the reflections of the candles looked like dim subaqueous glows through a forest of seaweed. Mr. Pin was halfway across the floor when he realised that the only footsteps he could hear were his own. Mr. Tulip had veered off in the gloom and was dragging the shroud off something that had been pushed against one wall.
"'Well, I'll be a—' the man began. "'It's a ing treasure, or thought so, a genuine—' "'Ing intaglio Ernesto, too. See that mother-of-pearl work there?'
"'This isn't the time, Mr. Tulip.'
"'He only made 6 of them. Oh, no, they haven't even kept it intuned.'
"'God damn it, we're supposed to be professionals.'
"'Perhaps your colleague would like it as a present?'
said a voice from the centre of the room. There were half a dozen chairs around the circle of candlelight. They were an old-fashioned kind, and the backs curved out and up to form a deep, leathery arch that had presumably been designed to keep out the draughts, but now gave the occupants their own deep pools of shadow. Mr. Pin had been here before. He'd admired the setup. Anyone inside the ring of candles couldn't see who was in the depths of the chairs, while at the same time being fully visible themselves. It occurred to him now that the arrangement also meant that the people in the chairs couldn't see who was in the other chairs. Mr. Pin was a rat. He was quite happy with the description. Rats had a lot to recommend them, and this layout had been dreamed up by someone who thought like him. One of the chairs said,
"'Your friend Daffodil—'
"'Tulip,' said Mr. Pin.
"'Your friend Mr. Tulip would perhaps like part of your payment to be the harpsichord,'
said the chair.
"'It's not a ing harpsichord, it's a ing virginal,' growled Mr. Tulip. "'One ing string to a note instead of 2, so called because it was an instrument for ing young ladies.'
"'My word, was it?' said one of the chairs. "'I thought it was just a sort of early piano.'
"'Intended to be played by young ladies,' said Mr. Pin smoothly. "'And Mr. Tulip does not collect art. He merely appreciates it. Our payment will be in gems as agreed.'
"'As you wish. Please step into the circle.'
"'Ing harpsichord,' muttered Mr. Tulip.
The new firm came under the hidden gaze of the chairs as they took up their positions. What the chairs saw was this. Mr. Pin was small and slim and, like his namesake, slightly larger in the head than ought to be the case. If there was a word for him, apart from rat, it was dapper. He drank little, he watched what he ate, and considered that his body, slightly malformed though it was a temple. He also used too much oil on his hair and parted it in the middle in a way that was 20 years out of style, and his black suit was on the greasy side, and his little eyes were constantly moving, taking in everything.